Welcome to the Frederick Faith Debate on Frederick's News Radio, 930 WFMD. Brought to us by Putman Plumbing and Heating. How can we make you smile? I'm Troy Skinner. Normally, Jonathan Schweitzer would be at my side, but Jonathan is in Israel right now on a missions trip. Normally, we'd have a guest on, but without somebody to act as the foil, I felt like I would use this as an opportunity to catch up on emails that you are so kind to send to me almost each and every day. And I try to keep up with emails and post emails up on the website at least one a day on average. I try to throw one up there, and it's a way for us to try to be interactive with the show, but I can't get them all up there all the time, so I'm going to try to catch up with some of them here on the air as well. By the way, that website, go to WFMD.com, look for the Faith Debate page, and you'll find the blog right there, and a link to Jonathan's blog as well. All right, so let's dive right in to your emails. This one's called Grandpa's Hands. It says, this is good. I'll never look at my hands the same way again. Grandpa, some 90-plus years, sat feebly on the patio bench. He didn't move, just sat with his head down, staring at his hands. When I sat down beside him, he didn't acknowledge my presence, and the longer I sat, I wondered if he was okay. Finally, not really wanting to disturb him, but wanting to check on him at the same time, I asked him if he was okay. He raised his head, looked at me, and smiled. Yes, I'm fine. Thank you for asking, he said in a clear, strong voice. Didn't mean to disturb you, Grandpa, but you were just sitting here staring at your hands, and I wanted to make sure you were okay, I explained to him. Have you ever looked at your hands? He asked. I mean, really looked at your hands? I slowly opened my hands and stared down at them. I turned them over, palms up, and then palms down. No, I guess I had never really looked at my hands as I tried to figure out the point he was making. Grandpa smiled and related this story. Stop and think for a moment about the hands you have, how they have served you well throughout your years. These hands, though wrinkled, shriveled, and weak, have been the tools I have used all my life to reach out and grab and embrace life. They braced and caught my fall when, as a toddler, I crashed upon the floor. They put food in my mouth and clothes on my back. As a child, my mother taught me to fold them in prayer. They tied my shoes, pulled on my boots. They held my rifle, wiping my tears when I went off to war. They've been dirty, scraped and raw, swollen and bent. They were uneasy and clumsy when I tried to hold my newborn son. Decorated with my wedding band, they showed the world that I was married and loved someone special. They wrote the letters home and trembled and shook when I buried my parents and spouse and walked my daughter down the aisle. Yet they were strong and sure when I dug my buddy out of a foxhole and lifted a plow off of my best friend's foot. They have held children, consoled neighbors, and shook in fists of anger when I didn't understand. They have covered my face, combed my hair, and washed and cleansed the rest of my body. They have been sticky and wet, bent and broken, dried and raw, and to this day, when not much of anything else of me works real well, these hands hold me up, lay me down, and again continue to fold in prayer. These hands are the mark of where I've been and the ruggedness of my life. But more importantly, it will be these hands that God will reach out and take when he leads me home. And with my hands, he will lift me to his side, and there I will use these hands to touch the face of Christ. I will never look at my hands the same again. But I remember God reached out and took my grandpa's hands and led him home. When my hands are hurt or sore, or when I stroke my face of my children, the face of my children or wife, I think of Grandpa. I know he's been stroked and caressed and held by the hands of God. I too want to touch the face of God and feel his hands upon my face. When you receive this, say a prayer for the person who sent it and watch God's answer to your prayer and his work in your life. Let's continue praying for one another. Passing this on to anyone you consider a friend will bless you both. Passing this on to one not considered a friend is something Christ would do. It's a cool story, If you've listened to this show for any length of time, you know, I'm not a big fan of those, the way they end these chain emails with the pressure to pass them along. If it's something you want to pass along, you will. I don't need somebody telling me to pass it along and put me on a guilt trip. But all the things, the simplest things, are hands, which aren't simple, actually very complicated the way the bone structure is built, but everything we have in life is a blessing. You ever look at your feet, for example? Look at your nose, your ears, your eyes, you know, your house, all the material things you've been blessed with. We take so many things for granted. That's one of the points I think we can take away from that email. Here's an email. It's headlined Thought for the Day. In case we find ourselves starting to believe all the anti-American sentiment and negativity, we should remember England's Prime Minister Tony Blair, or former Prime Minister Tony Blair's words during an interview when asked by one of his parliament members why he believes so much in America. He said, "A simple way to take measure of a country is to look at how many want in and how many want out. Only two dividing forces have ever offered to die for you, Jesus Christ and the American GI. One died for your soul, the other for your freedom. You might want to pass this on, as many seem to forget both of them." This is interesting. It always makes me nervous when we want to equate Jesus Christ with anything else. An American GI, a firefighter, a police officer, you know, what have you. It always makes me a little bit nervous, but, you know, the point's well taken. You know, Jesus not only offered to die for you, he actually did, according to Christian belief, die for you and then defeat death by raising three on the third day. But anyway, not a sermon. Another email. This one is subject prayer request. It's got some pictures of soldiers over in, it looks to be Iraq. Many of the soldiers are huddled around each other in prayer. A couple of them are actually not huddled, but off by themselves in prayer. And then it says here, the message being below these pictures says, "Prayer chain for our military. Please don't break it. Please send this on after a short prayer. Pray for our soldiers. Please don't break it." And the prayer says, "Lord, hold our troops in your loving hands. Protect them as they protect us. Bless them and their families for their selfless acts that they perform for us in our time of need. Amen." And then it goes on to say, prayer request, "When you receive this, please stop for a moment and say a prayer for our troops around the world. There's nothing attached. Just send this to people in your address book. Don't let it stop with you, please. Of all the gifts you could give a Marine, U.S. soldier, sailor, airman, and others deployed in harm's way, prayer is the very best one. God bless you for passing it on. Amen." Again, we have the, you know, kind of the guilt trip thing about passing it on, but I will say, I agree with the sentiment, there is nothing, no better gift, no more powerful gift you can give anybody than prayer. So it's bordering on a pet peeve. It's not quite a pet peeve, but it borders on a pet peeve for me when people say, "Well, all we can do now is pray. That's all we can do now." As if, well, we tried everything else that was sure to work. Now we're left with nothing but prayer. I guess we'll have to at least try that for what it's worth. You know, that's where you start. You know, all you can do now is pray. Maybe that's all you should do. Maybe that's all you need to do. I don't know. Anyway, it's, like I said, it's not quite a pet peeve, but it's on the border. Maybe someday it'll evolve into a pet peeve. Yes, the Christian just said the word evolve. This one is called, the subline on this email, 9/11 broadcast story. And here's what it has to say. "A man from Norfolk, Virginia, called a local radio station to share this on September 11th, 2003. His name was... well, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to give the name. I mean, it says the name in this email, but I'm not comfortable giving the name. So his name was something, and these are his words. "A few weeks before September 11th, my wife and I find out that we were going to have our first child. She planned a trip out to California to visit her sister, and on our way to the airport, we prayed that God would grant my wife a safe trip and be with her. Shortly after I said amen, we both heard a loud pop, and the car shook violently. We had blown out a tire. I replaced the tire as quickly as I could, but we still missed her flight. Both very upset, we drove home. I received a call from my father, who was retired New York Fire Department. He asked what my wife's flight number was, but I explained that we missed the flight. My father informed me that her flight was the one that crashed into the Southern Tower in New York City. I was too shocked to speak. My father also had more news for me. He was going to help. This is not something I can just sit by for. I have to do something. I was concerned for his safety, of course, but more because he had never given his life to Christ. After a brief debate, I knew his mind was made up. Before he got off the phone, he said, "Take good care of my grandchild." Those were the last words I ever heard my father say. He died while helping in the rescue effort. My joy that my prayer of safety for my wife had been answered quickly became anger. I was angry at God, at my father, at myself. I had gone for nearly 2 years blaming God for taking my father away. My son would never know his grandfather. My father had never accepted Christ, and I never got to say goodbye. Then something happened. About 2 months ago, I was sitting at home with my wife and my son when there was a knock at the door. I looked at my wife, but I could tell she wasn't expecting anyone. I opened the door to a couple with a small child. The man looked at me and asked if my father's name was Jake. I told him that it was, and he quickly grabbed my hand and said, "I never got the chance to meet your father, but it is an honor to meet his son." He explained to me that his wife had worked in the World Trade Center and had been caught inside after the attack. She was pregnant and had been caught under debris. He then explained that my father had been the one to find his wife and free her. My eyes welled up with tears as I thought of my father giving his life for people like this. He then said, "There's something else you need to know." His wife then told, His wife then told me that as my father worked to free her, she talked to him and led him to Christ. I began sobbing at the news. Now I know that when I get to heaven, my father will be standing beside Jesus to welcome me, and that his family, this family, would be able to thank him themselves. When their baby boy was born, they named him after my father, in honor of the man who gave his life so that mother and baby could live. This story should help us to realize two things. First, that though it's been several years since the attacks, we should never let it become a mere tragic memory. And second, but most important, God is always in control. We may not see the reason behind things, we may never know this side of heaven, but God is always in control. Please take time to share this amazing story with those you love. You may never know the impact it may have on someone. God doesn't call the qualified. He qualifies the called. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. Psalm 136 is referenced there. And then it ends with a little slug line. The best kind of friend is the kind you can sit on the porch and swing with, never say a word, and then walk away feeling like it was the best conversation you've ever had. This is interesting. For somebody who's not a Christian, you know, let's say you're listening and you're not a Christian right now, this might be a hard thing for you to swallow, like, yeah, okay, whatever, didn't accept Christ, who cares? But I gotta tell you, from a Christian perspective, there is nothing more important, nothing, than the people that you know, that you love, that you care for, that you interact with, that you know that their eternal salvation is secured in Christ. And it eats at you when you don't think that's the case, or it can eat at you. But then you have to, again, the second point, main point in that email story is that God is always in control. So if somebody doesn't come to Christ, you know, God's got it under control, and he's got to trust him to figure it out. Anyway, very powerful story. Thank you for that email. Here's another one. This one is called "So Help Me." By the way, you're listening to the Frederick Faith Debate on Frederick's News Radio, 930 WFMD. I'm Troy Skinner, and we're catching up on the email bag today. This email says, "Shall we hire a monument engraver to go to Arlington National Cemetery and add the missing words?" A message from an appalled observer. Today I went to visit the new World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. I got an unexpected history lesson. Because I'm a baby boomer, I was one of the youngest in the crowd. Most were the age of my parents, veterans of the greatest war, with their families. It was a beautiful day. People were smiling and happy to be there. Hundreds of us milled around the memorial reading the inspired words of Eisenhower and Truman that are engraved there. On the Pacific side of the memorial, a group of us gathered to read the words President Roosevelt used to announce the attack on Pearl Harbor. "Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked." One elderly woman read the words aloud. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. But as she read, she was suddenly turned angry.
Wait a minute, she said. They left out the end of the quote. They left out the most important part. Roosevelt ended the message with, So help us God.
Her husband said, You're probably right. We're not supposed to say things like that now.
I know I'm right, she insisted. I remember the speech.
The two looked dismayed, shook their heads sadly, and walked away. Listening to their conversation, I thought to myself, Well, it has been over 50 years. She's probably forgotten. But she had not forgotten. She was right. I went home and pulled out the book my book club is reading, Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley. It's all about the battle at Iwo Jima. I haven't gotten too far in the book. It's a tough read because it's a graphic description of the World War II battles in the Pacific. But right there it was on page 58, Roosevelt's speech to the nation. It ends in, So help us God. The people who edited out that part of the speech when they engraved it on the memorial could have fooled me. I was born after the war. But they couldn't fool the people who were there. Roosevelt's words are engraved on their hearts. Now I ask, who gave them the right to change the words of history? Send this around to your friends. People need to know before everyone forgets. People today are trying to change the history of America by leaving God out of it. But the truth is, God has been a part of this nation since the beginning. He still wants to be, and he always will be. If you agree, pass this on. If not, may God bless you. Well, that's a nice way to, you know, encouraging to pass it along without putting too much guilt on them. You know, if you agree, pass it on. If not, well, may God bless you anyway. that's nice. You know, this is something that's troubling for those who are believers in God. The secularization of our country, it's a huge ongoing battle. The ACLU gets involved in a lot of these kinds of cases, and, you know, it just makes you wonder. Was it purposeful? It had to be, right? I mean, they stopped just short of that part of the quote, of the speech. They said everything except those words. You know, what's wrong with those words exactly? What's so wrong with those words? Are they that offensive? Apparently to some people they are. Anyway, not going to launch into a sermon right now. Speaking of America and God, here's one that's called, an email, it's called God Bless America. How appropriate, somebody writes. So here's what it says. While walking down the street one day, a United States senator is tragically hit by a truck and dies. Kind of a grim start to this email. His soul arrives in heaven and is met by St. Peter at the entrance. By the way, there's no biblical evidence that St. Peter stands by any pearly gates to enter people into heaven, by the way, just FYI. Anyway, so St. Peter says, back to the email, Welcome to heaven, says St. Peter. Before you settle in, it seems there is a problem. We seldom see a high official around these parts, other than God, I suppose, right? You see, so we're not sure what to do with you. No problem, just let me in, says the man. Well, I'd like to, but I have orders from higher up. What we'll do is have you spend one day in hell and one in heaven, then you can choose where to spend eternity. Really? I've made up my mind. I want to be in heaven, says the senator. I'm sorry, but we have our rules, says Peter. And with that, St. Peter escorts him to the elevator, and he goes down, down, down to hell. The doors open, and he finds himself in the middle of a green golf course. In the distance is a clubhouse, and standing in front of it are all his friends and other politicians who had worked with him. Everyone's very happy in an evening dress. They run to greet him, shake his hand, and reminisce about the good times they had while getting rich at the expense of the people. They play a friendly game of golf and then dine on lobster, caviar, and champagne. Also present is the devil, who really is a very friendly guy, who has a good time dancing and telling jokes. They're having such a good time that before he realizes it, it's time to go. Everyone gives him a hearty farewell and waves while the elevator rises. The elevator goes up, 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 and the door reopens on heaven, where St. Peter is waiting for him. Now, it's time to visit heaven. So 24 hours pass with the senator joining a group of contented souls moving from cloud to cloud, playing the harp, and singing. By the way, I'm deviating from the email here for half a second again. Not scriptural. Back to the email. They have a good time, and before he realizes it, the 24 hours have gone by, and St. Peter returns. Well, then, you spent a day in hell and another in heaven. Now, choose your eternity. The senator reflects for a minute. Then he answers, well, I never would have said it before. I mean, heaven has been delightful. But I think I would be better off in hell. So St. Peter escorts him to the elevator, and he goes down, down, down to hell. Now the doors of the elevator open, and he's in the middle of a barren land covered with waste and garbage. He sees all his friends dressed in rags, picking up the trash and putting it in black bags as more trash falls from above. The devil comes over to him and puts his arm around his shoulder. I don't understand, stammers the senator. Yesterday I was here, and there was a golf course and a clubhouse, and we ate lobster and caviar, drank champagne, and we danced. We had a great time. Now there's just a wasteland full of garbage, and my friends look miserable. What happened? The devil looks at him, smiles, and says, yesterday we were campaigning. Today, you voted. I'm not sure if that's a religious commentary so much as a political commentary. Very amusing. Thank you for that email. All right, here's an email. We have time for this? Yeah, we have time to get this email off. We've got a couple of minutes left. Oop, get my music ready. All right. A little behind-the-scenes action there for you. This one's called A Tale of Six Boys, and I think it was sent somewhere around Memorial Day, so I've had this one for a while. I just never got around to sharing it. Each year, I'm hired to go to Washington, D.C. with the 8th grade class from Clinton, Wisconsin, where I grew up, to videotape their trip. I greatly enjoy visiting our nation's capital, and each year I take some special memories back with me. This fall's trip was especially memorable. On the last night of our trip, we stopped at the 2 Iwo Jima Memorial. At the 2, that must be a typo. This memorial is the largest bronze statue in the world and depicts one of the most famous photographs in history, that of the 6 brave soldiers raising the American flag at the top of a rocky hill on the island of Iwo Jima, Japan, during World War II. Over 100 students and chaperones piled off the buses and headed towards the memorial. I noticed a solitary figure at the base of the statue, and as I got closer, he asked, where are you guys from? I told him we're from Wisconsin. Hey, I'm a cheesehead, too. Come gather around, cheeseheads, and I'll tell you a story. James Bradley just happened to be in Washington, D.C. to speak at the memorial the following day. He was there that night to say goodbye to his dad and has since passed away. He was just about to leave when he saw the buses pull up. I videotaped him as he spoke to us and received his permission to share what he said from my videotape. It is one thing to tour the incredible monuments filled with history in Washington, D.C., but it's quite another to get the kind of insight received that night. When all had gathered around, he reverently began to speak. Here are his words from that night. My name is James Bradley, and I'm from Antigua, Wisconsin. My dad is on that statue, and I just wrote a book called Flags of Our Fathers. It is the story of the 6 boys you see behind me. 6 boys raised a flag. The first guy putting the pole in the ground is Harlan Block. Harlan was an all-state football player. He enlisted in the Marine Corps with the senior members of his football team. They were all to play another type of game, a game called war. But it didn't turn out to be a game. Harlan, at the age of 21, died with his intestines in his hands. I don't say that to gross you out. I say that because there are generals who stand in front of this statue and talk about the glory of war. You guys need to know that most of the boys in Iwo Jima were 17, 18, 19 years old. He pointed to the statue. You see that next guy? That's Rene Gagnon from New Hampshire. If you took Rene's helmet off at the moment this photo was taken and looked at the webbing of that helmet, you would find a photograph of his girlfriend. Rene put that in there for protection because he was scared. He was 18 years old. Boys won the Battle of Iwo Jima. Boys, not old men. The next guy here, the third guy in this tableau, was Sergeant Mike Strank. Mike is my hero. He was the hero of all these guys. They called him the old man because he was so old. He was already 24. When Mike would motivate his boys in training camp, he'd say, let's go kill some Japanese, or let's die for our country. He knew he was talking to little boys. So instead he would say, you do what I say, and I'll get you home to your mothers. The last guy on this side of the statue is Ira Haynes. Pima Indian from Arizona. Ira Haynes walked off Iwo Jima. He went into the White House with my dad. President Truman told him, "You're a hero." He told reporters, "How can I feel like a hero when 250 of my buddies hit the island with me and only 27 of us walked off alive?" So you take your class at school, 250 of you spending a year together, having fun, doing everything together, then all 250 of you hit the beach, but only 27 of your classmates walk off alive. That was Ira Haynes. He had images of horror in his mind. Ira Haynes died dead, drunk, face down at the age of 32, 10 years after his picture was taken. The next guy going around the statue is Franklin Stousley from Hilltop, Kentucky, a fun-loving hillbilly boy. His best friend, who's now 70, told me, "Yeah, you know, we took two cows up on the porch of the Hilltop General Store. Then we strung wire across the stairs so the cows couldn't get down. Then we fed them Epsom salts." Yes, he was a fun-loving hillbilly boy. Franklin died on Iwo Jima at the age of 19. When the telegram came to tell his mother that he had died, it went to the Hilltop General Store. A barefoot boy ran that telegram up to his mother's farm. The neighbors could hear her scream all night and into the morning. The neighbors lived a quarter of a mile away. The next guy, as we continue to go around the statue, is my dad, John Bradley, from Antigo, Wisconsin, where I was raised. My dad lived until 1994, but he would never give interviews. When Walter Cronkite producers of the New York Times would call, we were trained as little kids to say, "No, I'm sorry, sir, my dad's not here. He's in Canada fishing." "No, there's no phone there, sir." "No, we don't know when he's coming back." My dad never fished or even went to Canada. Usually he was sitting there right at the table eating his Campbell soup, but we had to tell the press that he was out fishing. He didn't want to talk to the press. You see, my dad didn't see himself as a hero. Everyone thinks these guys are heroes because they're in a photo on a monument. My dad knew better. He was a medic. And it goes on and on and on. This is a pretty long email. I'm going to cut it short there and just say, pretty powerful stuff. I wish I could comment on it more, but I got to run. We're out of time. Sorry about that. Should have kept a closer watch on the clock. Thank you, Putman Plumbing and Heating, How Can We Make You Smile, for sponsoring the show, and thank you for listening. God bless.